Congress convenes for the first time tomorrow, a new Congress. Republicans hold the majority in the House and gain seats in the Senate. And we're going to talk this morning about what that means for economic policy. We're joined, as we often are, by David Wessel, economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. David, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steve.
So do the Republicans in the House, controlling the House, know what they want to do when it comes to economic policy?
Well, they certainly do rhetorically. They're for smaller government, they're for cutting spending, they're against raising taxes, and they want to repeal the health care program that President Obama got through Congress last year. But at this point, they're long on symbolism and short on specifics. One of their first acts is a way of showing people that they got the message in November is they're going to cut the House budget itself, the money they spend on themselves, by 5%. They're talking about spending $100 billion less on domestic programs, but they haven't said exactly what they've cut. They're going to pass a bill next week, probably, that will repeal the Obama health care initiative. They know it won't get through the Senate, and they haven't said how they would propose to cut health care spending or maintain access for people who are uninsured or deal with aging or technology. So they know what they want. They just haven't been able to explain to us the specifics.
Well, it's interesting you say rhetorically they know what they want to do, because when they talk about cutting spending, aren't economists saying that government spending in the short term, not the long term, but in the short term has actually been helpful to the economy?
Well, that's true. Keynesian economists and those who work for the president think government spending has been an important part of offsetting the depressed private demand. They don't quite subscribe to that theory, and the kind of spending cuts they're talking about, they think are wasteful spending or spending that people don't want. They are taking their cue from the voters who said that, in their opinion, that government got too big.
So what are the likely earliest points of conflict here?
Well, there's going to be some fights over what's called rescissions, repealing spending that's already been approved by Congress, such as the $12 billion or so remaining of the original Obama stimulus. There is this need to keep the government going, to fund the government after March. The current authorization expires in March. And the Republicans say they want to cut $100 billion out of spending other than defense, veterans, and national security. That would mean a 20% cut in everything else. That seems pretty heroic. And finally, there's going to be a confrontation about raising the debt ceiling. It's now at $14.3 trillion. The government's likely to hit that level in March or April. Speaker Boehner says they're going to do it. They're not going to let a government default. But the question is, what conditions will Republicans put on that in order to make this must-pass legislation get through?
Oh, you say default because the government is in such a situation that it would need to borrow more to be continuing to pay its existing debts. That's the
situation. Exactly. Even if they cut spending now, they can't cut the deficit to zero. That means they'll be borrowing more, and they need authorization to do that.
We've talked about some of the points of conflict. I wonder if we get to an issue like free trade, is there an area where the administration and Congress, Republicans in Congress, might find common ground?
There might be. You know, there's a pending South Korea free trade agreement. There's likely to be opposition both from liberal Democrats and some populist Republicans. If it passes, it will only pass because President Obama and the leaders of the Republican Party in Congress find some of their members willing to vote for it. I suspect that won't be partisan. It'll be contentious, but it won't be a Republican versus Democrat thing.
David, thanks very much, as always.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here on Morning Edition.
Now to the case of one community college that's defying a trend. Because of serious budget shortfalls, many state universities are threatening to cut humanities programs such as foreign languages or philosophy. Even some private universities are doing the same. But at a community college in Queens, the philosophy program is king, as NPR's Margot Adler reports.
LaGuardia Community College has no real campus. Classes take place in four former manufacturing buildings. There are 17,000 matriculated students, plus many thousands more who take non-degree programs. There's a well-regarded nursing school, engineering, veterinary technology. But here's a surprise. 4,500 students are taking philosophy. 150 sections, 7 full-time professors, most of them added in the last 2 years. Peter Katopas is the interim president of LaGuardia. He says, people tell me the role of community colleges is narrow, to train students for tomorrow's jobs.
What are these jobs?
The real task, he says, is training students for what he calls the entrepreneurship of the imagination.
It's giving students the opportunity to really understand the context of their lives. And you do that through the humanities. If you do even a cursory survey of very successful CEOs, you will find that an unbelievable number of them did their undergraduate degrees in English or philosophy or history.
All kinds of students are taking philosophy here. Liz Montesclaros is 29. She needed a job, and without thinking much about it, she joined the military.
It's not the best place for questioning. Very rigid, very structured. When I finally got out, that's when I decided, hey, this is what I really want to do. I want to explore the questions that matter to me. What are we doing here? Why am I here in the first place? For what purpose?
E.J. Lee is 22 and started out as a business major.
My parents were, you know, growing up, make money, make money, make money. So I figured, you know, business is what you do. But as a business major, I was required to take an ethics course. And as soon as I sat in that class, I knew that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
These are the kind of attitudes you might find normal at a four-year liberal arts college. But the students here speak 120 different languages, and most of them were not born in the United States.
We're all so different on the outside, and on the inside, we're all searching, we're all seeking.
Gabriel Lockwood is 36. He wandered through Europe, knows a half dozen languages, worked as a translator, took courses at various European universities, but couldn't get credit for them in the United States. So at 36, he's starting again. He's full of questions, and philosophy, he says, has helped to answer some of them. The classes in philosophy are the usual: introduction to philosophy, ethics, medical ethics, religion and philosophy, political philosophy, logic, aesthetics, Eastern philosophy, but also new courses being developed in African philosophy and Latin philosophy. John Chafee is the chair of the department and says philosophy is a necessity, not a luxury.
It's something which is really at the heart of life. It addresses the foundational questions that we all wrestle with. And these are questions that Viktor Frankl said burn under our fingernails. Philosophy is a discipline that gives us the tools to really understand ourselves and the skills to answer the mysteries that are really at the heart of ourselves and at the heart of life.
Today, the Philosophy Club is meeting. More than a dozen students and two professors sit in a circle and debate happiness. Professor Richard Brown asks, suppose you lived a totally pleasurable life.
But then you found out the day after that, that you had been living in a virtual reality for your whole life and that you'd never actually done any of those things. But you'd had all the experience, you'd had all the pleasure, you'd had all the satisfaction, you had all the contentment. Would you say that you were happy in those previous experiences?
Arthur Rodriguez, Javier Velasco, and Mohamed Bahi begin to argue.
Even if this life is a dream and then we wake up when we die and we accomplish nothing, you still can't take away the experience of that dream of what you thought you accomplished.
If you had no suffering, you can't really recognize happiness or appreciation for something if it's always there.
It's like saying that, oh, you're not divorced, you're just married once. You don't really don't love your wife. It's like,
you don't have divorce.
They bring very different things to the mix.
Minerva Ahmad teaches introduction to philosophy and Eastern philosophy.
It's more personal here, it's more challenging here, but also the results that you get are way more surprising than what I got at other kind of institution.
Everyone's got problems, but our students have a lot of real serious real-life issues.
Philosophy professor Richard Brown.
And then to suddenly see them become curious about, well, the nature of forms or universals or what's the morally right thing to do, it's really a privilege. These people never envisioned that they'd be studying these kinds of things and also understanding it and having it influence their life.
5 years ago, there wasn't even a philosophy major at LaGuardia. Now 60 students are majoring, and several I talked to said they want to teach in the future. Liz Montesclaros.
I'm just struck by the passion of the people who are here, the faculty and the students.
The president of LaGuardia Community College made philosophy a priority. The department chair built a department and hired faculty. Now this community college in New York City, that's under many people's radar, has more philosophy majors than many four-year colleges and universities. Like that line in the film Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
This weekend, 10-year-old Catherine Aurora Gray found something that's 240 million years older than she is. The girl from the Canadian province of New Brunswick is the youngest person ever to discover a supernova, an exploding star. Supernovas can briefly shine as brightly as an entire galaxy. Young Catherine Gray shares credit for this discovery with amateur astronomers Dave Lane and her father, Paul Gray. This is his 7th supernova discovery.
There are friends of mine who have searched for supernovas, and they have searched close to 2,000, 3,000 hours.
I thought I was lucky when I found my first one 15 years ago because we were only doing that for 56 hours and we got our first one.
Now, how many hours had it been for her?
15 minutes.
15 minutes, wow.
might have been 10 minutes.
10-year-old Catherine Gray says she found the supernova using a computer program that compares nighttime images of the sky taken through a telescope.
It takes two different pictures, an older picture and a newer picture that were taken on New Year's Eve by my dad's friend. So I was looking at the images on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
I hit blank. It's a little button, and I hit blank, and it put the two pictures together. And then you just look around the little galaxy there, like a little ball of light that's blinking.
So in other words, this computer program, if I have this right, is putting two images on top of each other, and if there's something there...
If it's not there on the older picture, then it starts to blink.
And that's what you're looking for, something blinking.
Yes.
And what did you think when you saw this thing blinking at you?
Well, it's like, well, a good possibility. So I was kind of excited that I might have found one, but I didn't want to get my hopes too high in case it wasn't.
But it turned out that it was. It's been verified, right?
Yes.
And the supernova has a name now, right? 2010
yes. LT. 2010 LT.
No way to get it named after you?
No.
No. Is that disappointing at all?
Yeah, they do it in alphabetical.
Do you stop and think, Catherine, that this supernova is 240 million light years away? Can you even imagine what that distance means?
It's just so far away, you'd never be able to see it with only your eyes. You can probably barely see it with a telescope, too.
Do you think, Catherine, that this is something you want to keep on doing, either for fun or maybe when you're grown up, doing something with astronomy?
Well, I'm just going to keep it as a hobby, I think.
What do you like about it?
Well, I like being able to look at the stars and, okay, there's the Big Dipper and there's Venus. And it's cool to be able to point those things out that I know.
Do you have a favorite constellation?
My favorite constellation is called Orion. He's an archer, I think.
An archer, yeah. He's a big one, a big bright one.
Yeah.
He's about one of the only ones I can ever find, so he's a good one for me, too.
I like him. I always liked looking at Orion.
Well, Catherine, thanks so much for talking to us. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's 10-year-old Catherine Aurora Gray of Fredericton, New Brunswick, the youngest person ever to discover a supernova. It's in the constellation of Camelopardalis in the galaxy UGC 3378, which is 240 million light years away. You're listening to NPR. Not only can you update your Facebook status on your smartphone, you can also manage your bank account. But security experts warn that as more people bank by phone, more criminals can steal by phone. Jacob Fenston has the story.
April Carson hasn't been inside a bank for 5 years. She says she can do everything she needs to on her mobile phone, wherever she is.
On the metro, commuting to and from work.
Today, she's at a coffee shop. As she sips her cappuccino, she opens her bank's app on her iPhone and taps in the password.
You know, that is one pain, like minor pain. Sometimes my fingers are too big, and so I put in the wrong password.
She unfolds a check to deposit, holds up her phone, takes a photo, uploads the image to her bank.
And boom, you have $200 in your account.
About 1 in 10 U.S. households uses mobile banking now. According to market research firm Nielsen, only a handful of banks let you make mobile deposits, but most offer some mobile features, even small local banks.
Now it's an expected service when people come to bank with us.
Alice Frazier with Cardinal Bank in Virginia. When her bank rolled out its mobile website, many customers were leery. Now, 3 years later, just under 10% use the mobile site to check balances or transfer funds. Frazier says it's just as safe as using your desktop PC.
What you need to know is that no customer information is saved on the phone. It goes away when the transaction's complete.
But that's not always the case with the downloadable apps put out by banks, says mobile security expert Andrew Hoag.
When people, let's say in my family and friends group, say, well, should we use this mobile banking app on our cell phone? I'm fairly skeptical of it. I certainly don't do it.
Hoag runs a company called Via Forensics. It recently tested 6 of the most popular banking apps for potential weaknesses, and only one passed. Some, like Wells Fargo's Android app, stored critical information on the phone in plain text.
We were able to come in and find your username. We were able to find your password, and we were able to find out all of the different information about your bank account, about who you were buying services from, who you were paying, what your mortgage was costing.
Wells Fargo and other banks responded quickly with fixes, but Hoag worries rapidly changing technology means developers put speed ahead of security. Inside the banking industry, security experts are less skeptical.
I have begun to use mobile banking myself, yes.
Paul Smoser is in charge of technology at the banking trade group Financial Services Roundtable.
We haven't seen a whole lot of malicious software yet. Part of that relates to the fact that there are so many different manufacturers and operating systems in the mobile world. But part of it, I think, is also due to the fact that this is a relatively new environment. And unfortunately, crime follows growth.
But he says new technology could eventually make banking by cell phone safer than banking online or at an ATM.
Facial biometrics is something that we're looking at as an industry.
That means using the cell phone's camera to verify who's trying to access an account. Cell phones of the future could also use fingerprints to check identity. In the meantime, Smoser has some simple advice for mobile bankers. Treat your phone like you would a credit card.
My phone is now much more than a phone. It is an enabled device that allows me to do financial transactions.
In other words, don't lose it. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Fenston.
This is NPR. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. What if, through an accident, you lost your ability to express yourself in your native language, and if all your communication depended on speaking and understanding a foreign tongue? That is the scenario in a debut novel by the Chinese-American writer Ruiyan Xu. Alan Chu says this review of The Lost and Forgotten Languages of Shanghai.
There's a kind of useful symmetry at the outset of Xu's appealing first novel. At the beginning of the book, Li Jing, a Charlottesville-born Chinese stock trader, survives a gas explosion in a restaurant. But because of trauma from the accident, he loses his ability to speak Chinese. His old professor father and his wife Mei Ling, a book editor, are understandably distressed. Chinese has become to Li Jing, well, Greek to him. For example, he can hear the differences in tone that make meaning clear in Chinese, but as Xu writes, he finds it impossible to enunciate the four variations. For him, it's like hearing a piece of music and then looking down at the black and white keys of a piano, not knowing how each note corresponds to the identical-looking keys before you. Wife and father make a plan with a local hospital to fly in Rosalind Neal, an Oklahoma City doctor who's an expert in aphasia. Dr. Neal has her own problems, mainly having just suffered the explosion of her failed marriage, and the exotic sights and sounds of Shanghai only add to her confusion. She works with Li Jing in English to help restore his Chinese. But the main thing that happens? They fall in love, with upsetting results for the entire family. Novelist Ruiyan Xu writes in English, so she doesn't enunciate the four tonal variations of Chinese. The tone of her story about love in modern Shanghai seems just right.
The novel from Ruiyan Xu is called The Lost and Forgotten Languages of Shanghai. Our reviewer Alan Chu teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Like the shortwave broadcasts of Radio Free Europe and the Xeroxed samizdats of the Cold War, many hail the Internet as a force for liberation, a tool to challenge the censorship and repression of authoritarian regimes. In 2009, Iranian protesters tweeted, blogged, and emailed cell phone videos of violence, which prompted some to declare the victory of social media revolution. That hope, says Evgeny Morozov, has failed to materialize. The revolution, he says, will not be Twittered, but the next authoritarian crackdown might be, and not in the way we might hope. We want to hear from you. Do you think social media can change the world? Have you seen evidence of that? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, Evgeny Morozov is a contributing editor to Foreign Policy, now a visiting scholar at Stanford. His new book is The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, and he's joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Hi, glad to be here.
And you used to be in the other camp. What made you change your mind?
I never actually doubted that the internet is important and that social media is important. And, of course, they are changing the world. It's just that the more I started looking into this matter, the more I realized that the change was not always positive. So, yes, they are affecting the world, but it also looks like that the other side, the authoritarian governments, are getting empowered as well. Whether it's through surveillance, them tracking down what's happening on social networks, trying to identify who all of those people tweeting, whether it's through creation of propaganda. We are seeing a lot of these regimes go online and start creating blog posts and Twitters and even tweets and even hire bloggers to actually, push their messages. And there is, of course, another separate layer of censorship, which we get to hear about much more often than propaganda or surveillance. And all of that taken together, I think we actually empowers the other side much more than it does the social, the social movements and the dissidents and the human rights activists.
I guess the first time we heard about this idea that the net would set us free was Moldova. This was part of the old Eastern Bloc, and that was the first time we heard that people were blogging and tweeting and trying to organize protests against the government by use of the internet.
Well, that's, I mean, even before that, we heard a lot of, positive news about the use of new media in Kenya and Burma. And I mean, so it does extend much further than Moldova. I think Moldova was the case where Twitter really came to prominence and the label of Twitter Revolution became really prominent. I was actually one of the people who thought that Twitter was playing a much greater role in facilitating the protests than it actually turned out to be. As it happened, there were still a lot of networks which are analog, which are not visible. Those are human networks. Those are, protesters talking to each other on the phone or just talking to each other in real life and actually encouraging each other to appear in the square. And, of course, the only thing we can see is the digital networks. It's the Twitter messages and the Facebook messages. And, of course, there is this tendency to attribute everything that happens to the internet as opposed to this other analog stuff, which is invisible.
After the Iranian presidential election, a lot of reporters were thrown out of the country. Many more were denied permission to go in the first place. Much of the news that came out, including the famous video of a woman being shot to death, was provided by Twitter, emailed cell phone videos, that sort of thing.
Of course. I mean, social media does play a great role in facilitating access to information and in trying to picture what's actually happening in repressive environments like Burma or Iran. On the other hand, what we have seen happen in Iran after the elections was the Iranian government actually collecting all the emails, all the Twitter messages, all the Facebook posts, analyzing them, and often even going after the people whose names were mentioned. They actually posted a lot of photos from the square to a government news website, and they actually asked people to start identifying who are those protesters, and they went and arrested many of them. So, of course, the visible stuff, the stuff that does get into the media during the protests is, of course, the dying nada on the pavement of Iran, all of the stuff that happens after the elections, when the government actually goes after many of those protesters using social media and using some of the technology provided to Iran by Western companies like Nokia, Siemens, and many others, all of that gets far less coverage. And I think that's something that needs to be corrected. We do need to see the darker side as well.
What do you take from as the lesson of the experience of Google in China, where at one point it was going to leave the country because, it was being subjected to censorship?
I think Google's entrance into China was a typical utopian undertaking where they basically saw that giving people access to information will transform the Chinese state. And they saw that they were playing a positive role. However, I think they underestimated the enemy that we're facing. And the Chinese government proved much more sophisticated, launching cyber attacks on the inboxes and mailboxes of human rights activists, of constantly pressuring Google Google to do more and more censorship. In a sense, Google struck a deal with a party which doesn't want to adhere to the terms. So the Chinese government kept adding more and more demands, at some point making it very uncomfortable for Google to stay in the country. What I think happened is that Google really used this occasion to change slightly its presence in China. I mean, they're still doing business there. They're still selling ads. I think what they really managed to do was to get the U.S. government behind it and get a better leverage position. And, you know, they actually did it just a few weeks before Hillary Clinton made the very important Internet Freedom speech. And those issues became, connected. And I think the fact that the Washington got involved really helped Google to stay in China and still continue selling ads.
We're talking about the role of the Internet, social media, and the free flow of information in reducing the control of authoritarian governments with Evgeny Morozov. His new book is The Net Delusion. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Let's go to Taylor. Taylor with us from Fort Dodge in Iowa.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Very well. Thank you.
Well, great. Yeah, I think that we're going to continue to see a lot of changes that are coming from social media on the Internet. I'm a teacher at a community college. I teach sustainable energy. And I've just been amazed at the number of farm kids out here in Iowa that are aware of so many different issues that you just don't hear about on TV, like the growing demand for oil that we're seeing from China and India. I've got students that are aware of the fact that the United States increases its oil consumption by about 5% a year, and we've been doing that for a long time, but now China and India are growing with their consumption about 30% a year. And students are coming out of the cornfields of Iowa here wanting to get degrees in sustainable energy to be able to kind of ride the wave of the growing changes that we're going to see in the future. You know, just all kinds of crazy ideas that people pick up from the Internet.
You might want to update your information on U.S. consumption of oil. But anyway, that's an example of the use of the Internet, Evgeny Morozov, in mm-hmm. an atmosphere where it's not being repressed.
Sure, but I do not challenge the view that the Internet has increased access to information. And there are definitely many more resources, news articles, textbooks that are available to people in both China, Russia, Iran, but also in democracies. What I think we have to also remember is that access does not always translate into increased demand or interest. So what's happening in places like Russia or China is that most of the users and most of the young users who are online are actually using the web to either communicate with each other, chat. You know, pornography still plays a very big role, and most of the downloads are downloads of, you know, porn films as opposed to reports from Human Rights Watch. And I think we tend to idealize many of these people and think that what they are doing is some kind of dissent akin to what the, you know, Soviet dissidents were doing. And often it's the opposite. It's getting disengaged from politics and trying to find entertainment, which is very much demanded in many of these authoritarian states, which are pretty boring places to live in. And as I come from one, I come from Belarus, so I can actually attest that entertainment is one of the key demanded things online.
And subversive, too, in its own way.
Often it is, often it's not. To me, the key question is, how does it affect existing political movements that are pushing for change? And for many of them, it has become difficult to reach out to many of these young people who have more or less created a parallel universe online, and they are completely disengaged from the mainstream political processes.
Let's go next to Asia, and Asia with us from Ripon in Wisconsin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So one of my concerns, though, just talking about this, is what about people who are even more impoverished than we think of people in, like, China or Iran that don't even have access to these technologies? And then, I mean, they don't even pop up on their radar. So we're still only talking about people who have access to social media who are in emerging economies, but what about those who are in undeveloped economies? And then even should to certain things that facilitate social media be there, like, for instance, the fact that certain cell phone companies are exploiting Africans in certain African countries to mine the materials for the batteries and things. Do we all the social implications of even having social media or the tools that facilitate it in certain countries just seems kind of wrong to me.
I wonder what you think, Evgeny Morozov.
Well, I think that is certainly the problem of access. I think it is getting better, and mobile phones have played a role in facilitating access to information, but also, you know, to facilitating access to trade and banking and many other healthcare, many other services. However, I think we also have to remember that there are existing social and political and cultural practices in many of these countries, which may not necessarily be contributing to democracy. You know, bribery is one, for example. In Kenya, what we are seeing is local policemen are actually using mobile banking to hide the bribes that they receive from the drivers that they stop on the roads. So we have to consider the impact of social media through the lens of existing social and cultural processes and then see how each of them will be affected. Yes, people will get access to mobile banking and it will help many of them, but also, you know, the darker forces will get empowered as well, and in many cases they will be empowered disproportionately, thus making it less likely that democracy will prevail in the long run.
I think Asia was adding to the dark side by saying there's also a lot of Africans who have to work at very low wages to mine coltan and other
That's definitely happening. And we do need to push more internet and technology companies to sign up to principles of corporate social responsibility. And many of them still avoid signing up to any treaties saying that technology is apolitical and what they do has no bearing on social, political, cultural problems of today.
Including Facebook.
Including Facebook especially.
Right. Asia, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. And Evgeny Morozov, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Evgeny Morozov's book is The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News.